Hello and welcome back to the Focus on Linux podcast, recorded on the 1st of August 2024. My name is Christian, and today we have another very interesting topic to cover. If there's one thing that has become increasingly important in recent years, it is the funding of critical open source projects that have long been part of our everyday lives. One funding program that has set out to improve the situation is the Sovereign Tech Fund, which we want to cover today. In addition to this, we will also have a very exciting open source project reporting on its experience with the fund. Of course, I'm not going to do this all by myself, but I have two exciting guests today. One of those being Paun Chia. Hi, Paun.
Hi, glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for taking the time. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself? Who are you and what are you doing with the Sovereign Tech Fund?
Yeah, thank you, Christian. So my name is Paun. I work in communications at the Sovereign Tech Fund. Have had a history working in tech generally, doing marketing, product marketing, internationalization, and just generally thinking about humans and technology and how it affects our society. So for us, talking about what we do is almost as important as the open source technologies that we're financing and identifying, because we want to set an example out there for all the other potential governments out there, countries that are looking at the open source ecosystem and thinking about how critical it is for all the digital things that they're doing.
Yeah. Great. Thanks. It's great to have you on the show. And our second guest today is none other than Daniel Stenberg, being the maintainer and the founder of the Curl Project. Hi, Daniel.
Hello.
Okay, let's assume somebody of our listeners have been living under a stone for the last 20 years. How would you describe yourself?
I would probably say that I am a Swedish software developer. I've been doing open source networking internet protocols since the early 90s, I think. I mostly do, I'm known for, and I do curl, I work in curl full time since a while back, but I also do a few other open source network related things. So that's, I also spend a little bit of time within the IETF on protocol standardization, and I wrote a few books about curl and open source and stuff. That's what I do.
Great. It's a blast having you on the show, so thanks a lot for taking the time. Okay, let's start with the Sovereign Tech Fund. This is your elevator pitch, Paun. How would you describe the STF and why should people focus on it?
Well, first of all, the Sovereign Tech Fund is a German organization. So we are actually financed by the German Ministry for Economic Affairs and Climate Action, with the mission to strengthen digital infrastructure and open source ecosystems in the public interest. And we do that by supporting foundational open software components, including the people who work on them, making sure that they have the financing that they need, for at least the time that we're working with them, to focus on important things like maintenance, security updates, maybe just some critical accessibility things. There's a whole bunch of things that we find is best backed by public money. A little bit about our team. So we've existed almost 2 years now. We officially started, kicked off our pilot round in, I think, October of 2022. That's also how we're connected to Daniel, because Curl was part of that pilot round. There were just a couple people. Our founders, Fiona Krakenberger and Adriana Groh, had been working with this, getting it started. And we've grown since then. Now we just had another person start, so there's 14 of us, 14 people here working on this with a mix of open source backgrounds, software development, funding, technology, and all sorts of other things.
Great. So do you also have people that are actually supporting open source projects by contributing to the code, or what exactly is the focus area?
So right now we're focused on our team on identifying the technologies and then finding ways to commission work on them. So at the moment there are folks, of course, who are software developers and I think who work on open source in their spare time, like so typically, but most all of our day jobs in the moment are in the organizational side. We don't have anybody who's paid to contribute to projects.
What led into founding the Sovereign Tech Fund? So what was the initial idea that got kicked off? Do you have any details to share with us?
Yeah, so our sort of founding story, or whatever you want to call it, is that the two founders that we have right now, who I mentioned before, Fiona and Adriana, they had both worked in open source funding before. And this was, I think, during the time when Fiona was at the Open Tech Fund based in the US, and there was some worry in the Trump administration that this might be cut off and they were reduced heavily. And around the world, everybody was quite concerned about that there wasn't stable funding or any sort of government funding for this critical and foundational open source technologies. And so they got together with a few other folks and started, and with support from, I think, one of the ministries, wrote a feasibility concept and what it might look like for Germany, for example, to also become more active in this area and to put some money into digital infrastructure and these foundational technologies. And basically what happened is that, you know, sometimes these reports, they sit in someone's desk, don't get read, we're all quite busy, but it was, you know, there, and they had worked out a lot of the details that we're still following and implementing right now on how this might look. But then in, I think it was the winter, so late 2021, the Log4j vulnerability was discovered, and the whole world realized, finally, that there's some open source stuff that everybody uses, and that if it stops working or is vulnerable or there's a security issue, it impacts all of us, you know, whether or not we think we're using, you know, open source or not. You know, it's in servers, you know, it's connected to services and tools that all of us are using on our phones and our devices. And and so luckily there was already this, you know, this concept, these plans. And so that was picked up by the ministry and then implemented in the following year. So in 2022, after the sort of shock that the world, the reminder that it's important to support these critical technologies.
Sounds interesting. So what changed between the pilot round and Severin Tech Found these days? Did you have any additional programs that you introduced, or did you have any initial learnings from the first fundings that you had in the last 2 years?
Yeah, certainly. So we have, I kind of divided up into a few different areas that we work in. One is sort of general investment fund, where we call invest in the public interest in these technologies like Curl, like Fortran, like even PHP. Yeah. We're also working, for example, with the OpenJS Foundation on a variety of projects. We're basically there collaborating with the technologists, with the communities, and saying, hey, what are the things that you would want to work on these libraries, on these components that, you know, you're having a hard time getting to it? What would be the most beneficial? How can we put these into a service contract? How can we commission work on that with the funds that we have from the German government? So that's one area that we work on. That's going continuously. It's also possible to submit proposals to us. So if you go to our website, you'll find a way to apply. We list all of our criteria up there. We talk about, you know, the things that are important to us, the basic requirements, and happy to also, answer questions by email if you send those to us as well. But most of the information is on there. We try to make it as transparent and fair as possible. So that's the one pillar, and that's the thing that we've probably been doing the longest. And then the next thing that we do is the Bug Resilience Program, and this is a additional set of services that we offer. So in this case, we are connecting critical open source communities, people who are working on these technologies, with service providers that we've already contracted with. So there's a couple different things that are involved there. One is like a code audit. Mm-hmm. One is a bug bounty program, where not only does the person who finds the bug get a bounty, but we call it a bug and fix bounty, because, you know, not only do you need to find the bugs, but the person who fixes it also needs some support. So that's one of the cornerstones of the Bug Resilience Program. So those are services that we basically offer through the Bug Resilience Program. And if you're a security researcher, definitely check it out, because we have a whole bunch of bounties that have just gone up. It's pretty interesting in a way to, you know, do some good in the world, you know, while also maybe earning some rewards for finding those vulnerabilities. And and the third component, I guess, of the Bug Resilience Program is we also are working with an outfit that just supports people in reducing technical debt, you know, doing documentation, all the sorts of, just sometimes open source projects just need additional capacity and more power. So that's one of the aspects that fall into the Bug Resilience Program.
Oh, great. So let's say you stumble upon a project that is widely used, but the documentation isn't that good, then people can reach out to you, and then you can create contacts to people that want to help. Or how does it look like exactly?
So how actually that works, and sorry, I should explain it better. It's the Bug Resilience Program, you can also apply. Mm-hmm. So there's an application form where you can write down, you know, what is your open source project? What do you work on? Why is it critical? So we do evaluate based on the same sort of set of criteria that we have in the general funding program. And then what particular services are you interested in? So of those three, are you more interested in a security audit? Would you, do you want sort of more just what we call direct contributions? Do you just need more help on a variety of areas? So not just documentation, that's an example, but all the other things that might happen within a project. And then the third was the bug bounty. And then you can select which ones you're interested in. And at the moment, we're just doing it that it's a kind of like a first come, first serve. So if you meet the criteria to participate in the bug resilience program, then the team that's working on that, you know, sets up a call, you know, as soon as they are ready to do the intake and has a conversation with the project maintainers about, you know, other services that they're interested in, how would they work, and assuming everybody agrees and is on the same page, and they connect you with the service providers. And there's no cost to the project. That's the part that we're helping with, is we're paying the service providers who provide those different things already. Yeah. The next part that we have is the, and this was ran last year and the beginning of this year, the Contribute Back Challenges, and that's basically a program where we threw open the gates and said, please let us know what you are working on or what you use, what kind of open source you use. And if you had some money to contribute back to a particular project, you know, we were kind of targeting maybe software development companies, maybe agencies or consultancies, but, you know, even also just people working in their day-to-day life where they said, you know, if I got some money, I would be totally willing to work on this open source project that I usually just don't have time to support. And we worked in three different areas. That's why it's the Contribute Back Challenges. And people were able to apply for funding for two fairly short periods. So the first round was 4 months. And then after that, the participating projects had an opportunity to apply for another second round of 4 months with additional funding. Yeah. So there's no current challenge running at the moment, but we'll be sure to update and share that if there is something coming in the future. But what is new and exciting is that we just have introduced what we're calling the Fellowship for Maintainers. So this is something where we realized that all of these things that we were doing before, including the general investments, they don't always actually meet the reality or match the reality of the lived experience of maintainers, where they say, oh, I have a project where I have these 7 milestones that I want to do over the next 18 months or 9 months mm-hmm. or something like that. Often, let's say, the work of a maintainer is not easily captured in, you know, these normal service contracts with deliverables of the kind that we've talked about so far. So we really, we did a survey. We talked, I think we got responses from over 500 open source maintainers and said, you know, what would it look like? How could we best support you? With the idea that a lot of maintainers are actually not just a maintainer on one project, but maybe they're a key contributor in multiple ones. So maybe that's a way for us to support somebody, to strengthen the ecosystem, and also make sure that the important work gets done. So from you know, engaging with the community, to reviewing requests, to writing documentation, all the sorts of stuff that, as Daniel, I'm sure, can attest to, belongs to the work of a maintainer, but is not always like, oh, something that a company was like, that sounds like a great thing that we're going to pay for the next 6 months. So that's the long and the short of the fellowship. We haven't started taking applications yet, but we will announce that as soon as we do.
That sounds very interesting. So, I mean, that applies to nearly all of my projects. I would really need a maintainer for the most of my projects, but I think they are way too small. But I would be interested in hearing Daniel's take on this. So being part or being the main maintainer of Curl, how do you think about this new offering?
No, I think it's a great idea. I mean, the usual problem with applying for money from anyone actually is just that, exactly as Pawan mentioned, you have to somehow invent a couple of things you want to do and then ask for money to do those things. While in reality, in a normal, at least in my project, most of what I do is actually just maintaining. And, you know, reading others' pull requests, answering questions, handling day-to-day stuff, I think that's nowadays is more than 50% of what I do. And that's a really hard thing to ask anyone to pay for, because companies don't want to pay for that. And asking grants for that is also often usually hard, because people want, most of these different places you can ask for money from, they want something, they want me to tell what I want to do with the money, right? Not just sit at home and continue to do whatever I did the last few years. So I think it's a great idea, and I'm interested to read out about the details there, because I think, I mean, in our project, and I guess many projects, we are of course more or less always looking for ways how to finance or expand the financing or change the financing or make sure that the financing keeps on, you know, so that we survive or strive as a project. So as mentioned, we were already in the pilot program with the STF, but we're also, you know, constantly thinking about how maybe we should apply again for another, because we of course have more projects coming, and this fellowship program is also very interesting. So we are going to check it out and communicate with them about it.
Well, it's good to hear that we're not on the totally wrong track. We definitely, you know, had a lot of conversations with maintainers, and also based on the survey that I think Daniel also helped us reach a lot more people who responded to it. But I think in all the work that we do, we try to iterate and get feedback, and that's why we're starting pretty small. So I just want to set the expectations that we're probably only going to have a few maintainers in this first fellowship round, and then we'll also trying out different models. Some of them will do it maybe part-time, some for more time, you know, looking at the different ways that we can structure the options. Maybe some people will want mentoring, which is one thing we heard a lot, and other folks will not want as much coaching. But in the end, all of it is just to serve the goal of, we want to learn from this, we want to see if this model works. I mean, Daniel sounds hopeful. I am also very hopeful. But as it is in all such things, it really gets down to the nitty-gritty, to like the actual implementation. And it's great if we can learn from that and then hopefully expand in following years. Or maybe other, you know, countries, other organizations will see that the model works and that there's demand, and then we'll do another CURL maintainer fellowship or something like that. Yeah.
And I'm really I like the fact that it's actually a program that can work or addresses sort of the smaller projects here, because I think in general we need more attention to the smaller ones, not the big ones. The big ones usually have a better chance to get money in many different ways, but it's, as you mentioned, part-time stuff. It's the smaller projects where maybe you just spend part-time of your life on this project. It's really, really hard for those kind of maintainers. How do you actually start doing that part-time, or how do you make your hobby into something you actually get paid for to do? It's a really, really tough step. So I appreciate that we are sort of slowly getting more choices or more ways to actually fund those kinds of projects.
Definitely. I also think that this is just an awesome idea, because it's basically every time we read about another very crucial open source project that has gone bad, like xatutils being the most recent one, it relates to that maintaining a project is very time consuming. It's not that easy. And it's not just reading and writing code, it's more or less putting all the ties together. So reading merge or pull requests, decide whether this is a good idea to add to your project, and dealing with all those people wanting to help you. So having a special program for this looks really good to me, and I'm thrilled to hear how this will figure out in a year or so. So we should catch up one year later, definitely.
Definitely, I would love that.
Okay, so why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit how many projects have been supported by the STF and how many money has been spent very well on those projects? What do you think?
Yeah, well, we have, as we said, we're getting applications, getting proposals, reviewing those. We also do outreach. So we have two technologists now on staff who are keeping an eye sort of and looking at overall the different software ecosystem, open source ecosystems. So those are the two ways that we basically identify technologies. I'm responsible for updating the website about them. So I think we're not quite up to date on the website, but that's the easiest place to reference. So if you go to sovereigntechfund.de/tech, you can see all of the things that we published at the moment. about the technologies that we're supporting. I think we're over 40 now, but that's kind of what we have up on the site. But there's things that we mentioned. Curl was in the pilot round. Log4j, which of course was one of the things that inspired the creation or sort of kickstarted the creation of the Sovereign Tech Fund, is also a project that we're working with. Fortran, I think, was in both the pilot round and later on. It's an old programming language, right? But it's kind of gotten a fresh wind. There's a new community or a more active community around it. And we found there's an immense public interest in supporting sort of making the language more easier to work with, because so many, I think, climate scientists are using it to do large-scale modeling. So that's one of the really interesting things that is happening. And then we have a whole series, for example, a set of investments of projects that we're working with around memory safety. So for example, Prosimo is a project by the same folks who run the Internet Security Research Group. And they're looking at a whole bunch of different key internet infrastructure items. I think we're working a lot with them around, I think it was RustLS as an alternative to OpenSSL, a memory safe AV image and video decoder, and then also a DNS resolver. So those are some examples of the things that the Prosimo is doing. And then I think another one that I remember really well is Pendulum, is another project where they're working on making network time protocol and the precision time protocol also run on or be rewritten in Rust, because those are some specific things that are really, I guess, I have a hard time talking about it because it sounds magic. This is what I always say to people. They're like, it's about time and space and like measuring how devices, you know, keep each other in sync. And it just seems like such a huge problem. And I'm, you know, always in awe of the people who work on these things. Anyway, so there's a few examples, but there's a lot more. Hopefully there's something that strikes your interest if you want to take a look.
Yeah. Definitely. So I had a look at the website, and there are things like the Python package index, and that's one of my personal nightmares, waking up one day and figuring out that some bad actor made its upload to the PyPI, and one of the most crucial packages is just replaced by some malware, which also happened quite a few times for the NPM package index, as far as I'm concerned. So I think that's a very realistic horror scenario. But another problem that I stumbled upon a couple of months ago, there we had an outage of PyPI for a couple of hours, and then I realized how crucial PyPI and other, let's say, registries out there are for our everyday life. So I'm doing a lot of automation with Ansible, and we also had an outage of the Ansible Galaxy for a couple of hours, and guess what? I wasn't able to work for a couple of hours. I mean, it's okay, I found other tasks to do, but I think it points out where are the most crucial parts of our everyday infrastructure. And it's pretty good that you managed to select 40 of them. And I think, yeah, there are possibilities for even more projects. So do we have a pipeline going on right now of how many projects that might become part of the STF at some time too?
Yeah, so we're... I don't have any specific numbers, but we're constantly, our team is getting proposals. We're always doing scouting and outreach. And so they're busy reviewing, creating, sort of collaborating with the communities to develop sort of a scope of work. And then that gets reviewed, for example, or ranked by a set of external experts that we've got brought in to help us look at these projects in the greater context. And in the end, we're commissioning the work when it passes sort of the review on all those different levels. And I mean, we also have limited funds, so we try to work with longer contracts. I know that's also another thing we've learned, that it's really helpful when we commission this kind of work for it not to be just for a couple months, but for, you know, longer periods of time, 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, sometimes even longer. Just to give you an idea of the scale of the funds that we're working with, last year in 2023, we had 11.5 million euros available, and we committed also a bunch of that last year already to projects sort of running through 2024, just because that's how it works when you're sort of spending in the long term, or at least longer periods of time. And in this year, 2024, there's 17 million euros allocated to the Sovereign Tech Fund, some of which we're spending this year, or all of which will be spent and allocated this year. But we're also still waiting for the news about the 2025 German federal budget.
Great. Okay, let's make some more details. Let's say I have a project and I want to be founded by the STF. So maybe let's ask Daniel how things got started for the CURL project. So what is needed to get started?
Yeah, since I was part of the pilot, I actually started it slightly differently than anyone would start it now. But if you would start it now, you would just head over to their website and see how to apply to get funding from that fund. It's actually pretty straightforward. So you just have to go there and read up and fill in the forms. But when I got into this, I had no idea that this fund existed, and it actually didn't exist when they contacted me the first time. So I was pretty much just, you know, contacted and asked, hey, what about funding in open source? And then we had a discussion about that. And if curl would be funded, what could you do about it? And then, so it was a little bit of a back and forth. And then, so I came up with, we ended up with a bunch of projects that we wanted to do. And then we agreed to that these were fine projects for the STF to fund. So I basically got a little bit of a hand-holding, a little bit of a help there to get into that place where I had some things to get funded.
But I think you're a guinea pig for us too. I mean, that's why it was a pilot round. So you also, I think, you know, dealt with us just getting started. We were learning things as we were setting up, you know, the contracts and the payments and the invoices and all that sort of stuff. So we also really appreciate, and I think that's the thing that goes through all of our work, is that we appreciate the time that maintainers or the people that we're working with are also going, that's also going into working with us. And that's why we try to, for example, keep our application. I mean, it's not the shortest application in the world, but it's also not, you know, it's not, we're not asking for, you know, your mother's maiden name or whatever, all those sort of things like that, that you might get in other types of applications.
Yeah, and I think as an open source project, I think it's, learning from your mistakes, adapting and, you know, starting with something and then just improving and changing it over time. That's something we're all used to, right? So we appreciate that an organization we're working with can have the same mindset. So, of course, the first time stuff might not be, you know, polished and worked out, and then we just have a communication, we fix the things, and the next time it'll be better. So of course that's great that you can work like that. And I understood that we were part of that in the pilot program, but still, I mean, getting funding, it's of course it's worth for us to, sure, some of the things weren't that polished, and sure, we got into some, you know, issues, and we had to go back and forth a few times before we were all, you know, aligned properly. But hey, that's all within the sort of what we agreed to. And I think it's good for us then also to feel that, sure, we could help the Sovereign Tech Fund to get that stuff sorted for everyone else's benefit down the line. So felt good.
Yeah. Well, we definitely appreciate it. Yeah.
And I mean, that's basically what an MVP is, right? So it's a minimal viable product, and the first iteration might not be the shiniest experience, but it's somehow working, and it gives you the possibility to increase the experience for everybody. So that sounds pretty good to me. Okay, let's say you have the possibility to force some change that you would love to see in software development to improve the whole situation. So if you have any wish that you could get fulfilled, what would it be? Maybe let's start with you, Daniel.
Oh, wow. What a that's a big and lofty question. well, really. So I'm not much of a dreamer. I'm much more of a pragmatic, working with what we have and where we are. So I usually just try to, sure, if, I mean, we're working on open source, and pretty much every open source project feels that we're understaffed, we have more work that we want to do, but we can't. We want to have more contributors, but we don't. We want to have more sensible users who file better bug reports, but we don't. So, I mean, everything in every level can get better, right? So, I don't know. If I could dream of something that would be better, then pretty much everything can be better. But I'm also of an optimistic kind of person. So I think we're all going in the right direction generally. So things are getting better. I mean, everything from hosting services, funding projects, awareness tools, everything is getting better gradually, step by step. And that's, I think that's one of the sort of benefits or what you learn by being in this area or this ecosystem, this community for a long time, that you can actually see that. You can compare. How did we do this back in the 90s? Everything was much worse back then. So I think in general, we are going in the right direction. Of course, I could see that, sure, it would be better if we fixed a few of the problems faster. If we got more money, we got better funding, with more projects could actually survive better or manage all the problems. Maybe we wouldn't have any XZ attacks or something. Mm. But at the same time, well, sure, we had CrowdStrike the other day, right? So it doesn't matter if you have funding, you can still do mistakes. So we can't avoid mistakes even with funding. So we shouldn't just also not fool ourselves to think that it's not always funding. We also just need to have, we also need to do the work, right? So we have to just keep on. So I don't have any high lofty ideas or blue sky visions of what might happen. I'm much more of a realistic pragmatic. So this is what we have. I'm working with this.
It ain't much, but it's honest work. That sounds pretty relatable.
Right.
What about you, Pawn?
Well, I think my wish is also kind of more of like a mindset question. I wish that people, maybe not just in software development itself, like in the people doing the software, but generally for people to think about where software comes from. I mean, we ask people to think about, you know, how, where does your food come from? Who's growing it? I think we should ask ourselves often who's writing our software, what's going into it, who's maintaining it, what is sort of the whole societal edifice that goes into keeping this going. And I mean, that's of course very related to our mission, but I think we can ask ourselves that always, like what, if you're a software developer, what libraries are you pulling into your stuff? Who's maintaining them? Are you also helping support the dependencies? Are you thinking about your dependencies? And what, not just copying something from the internet, but you know that's somebody's work. And how is it going to keep being updated? How are you going to update it once it gets updated? All those sorts of things. And I think also on the user level, or let's say in the government or in companies, we all need to think a little bit more about where our stuff comes from and how we can responsibly use it, which also can mean contributing back or even just being aware that, you know, there's somebody out there who's, you know, spending their, you know, instead of drinking beer at on the side of a lake or something like that by a lake, they're sitting and coding and, you know, running some updates and answering questions or something like that.
Speaking of the need of funding valuable open source projects, I've been thinking about, and I would be interested in hearing your thoughts on this, Daniel, how bad the situation really is. So I have a feeling that most companies are still more consuming than supporting open source software. And I know that you get quite a lot or quite often emails by people who are using curl and think whenever they have a problem that you are responsible in helping them personally. So what would you say in comparison with the times back then?
Yeah, I think in general, of course, companies in general, of course, they use stuff for free because it's possible and it's open source. So they can do that legally, morally, maybe questionable, but there's nothing preventing them from doing that. And it's business. So they earn a lot of money by doing that. Possibly, you know, sometimes we can argue that, sure, it's in the company's own benefits to make sure that every dependency they sort of build upon strive and survive and is sustainable so that they don't get any, you know, weird security problems down the line. But still, I think it's much more common that companies just use open source rather than try to actually contribute or fund or help in any way. So, because I also want to go back and say that, you know, open source is not only about funding, right? Open source is mostly about maintaining and getting the code done, managed and everything. So it would be awesome to just forget about the money. What if someone just let your employees spend X amount of hours on my project? You know, that would be awesome. I don't need the money always. And I mean, not just me, but projects in general, right? So just having manpower would be an awesome funding as well in many cases. So yeah, a lot of companies do that. And again, I think it's a market economy thing that makes them do that. So sure. And also the way I often get into touch with people is that I get in contact with the engineers, right? And the engineers often feel that they don't have the money. They might have the questions and they have the problems, but they don't have the money to actually, you know, hey, I'm only working with your software project in my commercial surrounding, but that I'm just, you know, I'm just the guy down in the mine. I don't pay anyone. So they want the help. They want the free help from me for their, you know, giant tech company, but because they can't pay me, and the one who can pay me, they won't pay me. So of course it's a little bit like that. One of my favorite examples is a few years ago when one of these giant companies actually responded to their own customers that you should go and talk to the curl project about help with curl, right? We ship it to you and we charge you enormous amount of money, but you should talk to that open source project, and they do that on their spare times, and you can ask them about help, right?
So wow.
And they do that, you know, without feeling ashamed or even trying to, you know, hide it or anything. That's just a mindset. So, and of course, then it comes from, and there's also a lot of good companies, of course, that try to do the right thing and try to spend manpower, money, and help out where they can. So there are all sorts out there. So I don't know. How bad is it? I don't know. I think it's like everything. We have all kinds. Are we going in the right direction? I think we do. I think it's a slow transition in the right direction, at least for some areas of the ecosystem, but open source is huge. So even if we slowly go in the right direction, I think we have an enormous amount of projects that are certainly without funding, understaffed, and sort of in a problematic situation.
I mean, I don't want to be too pessimistic about it either, because I want to say open source as a movement, as an idea, as a way of creating software is hugely successful, right? There's so many things out there that are being used. That's why we're even talking about it. People are creating, they're sharing, they're working together. And I think what we're seeing now is just that because of the spread of its success, that it's used everywhere. And as the world gets more and more digitized, as software appears everywhere, then open source then also appears everywhere. And I think we're starting to notice that's one of the reasons why some of these vulnerabilities or these issues get so much widespread recognition when suddenly everybody thinks, oh yeah, the whole world could shut down if this component stops working or has a fatal error in it or becomes vulnerable. But I think that means there's some recognition of it, and maybe we just need to catch up in how we think about how open source is funded or how the basics are taken care of and maintained. And I mean, and just to give like a glimmer of some positive conversations that we've been having, a lot of people are watching, I think, of what the Sovereign Tech Fund is doing, what Germany is doing generally in the open source area. I mean, there's also other good examples in other places. I'm not saying Germany is the only one, but we're hoping that, you know, and we try to be as transparent about our work as we can, that someone will just copy us. I mean, we would love to see a copy somewhere, any country. Like, well, we're happy to talk to you. and there's people who are interested, and sure, you know, it takes the right political moment, the right amount of the people in the key places who are able to get something like that started and get it funded. But I think the possibilities are there, and that's makes me optimistic.
Yeah. Exactly. I think that's a lovely optimistic take on everything, because just look at you as a single fund, the STF here. That's Germany alone, right? It would be enough if you would have a number of copies or clones of your setup, and they would be a drastic improvement. So sure, you have certainly set an example and shown how it can be done, and it actually helps projects everywhere. So we can just hope and wish that a few other countries or regions or other ways of creating this kind of funds can pop up. And then suddenly maybe we could have a huge sort of shift in how we deal with these things.
Yeah, and I think it's, I mean, because we are a government supported and funded project, that's sort of my first thing that I think about. But I also see, just like there are in other areas of society, everybody, not just to say sort of easily, everybody should support open source, but we're happy to also coordinate and work with people in the private sector. I mean, there are some companies that support open source already, but there's definitely more work that they can do. They can look sort of further, I would say, I'm never sure if it's up or down, but deeper into their dependencies, looking at what is there. Maybe not just the things that are most directly impacted, impacts their company's security or value chain, but just think about all the stuff that also relies on. And we would support, you know, companies of all sizes also becoming more active, not only in money, as we've talked about. I mean, that's definitely important, but also in like like Daniel mentioned, giving their employees who are able to time and rewarding contributions to open source, because it's part of, you know, securing the overall business strategy.
And I mean, although security issues have also something good, so let's face it. So I think 5 years ago, people weren't caring that much about things like sustainability or software bill of materials and what are my dependencies? Are they good? Do I need to update all my libraries? And I think this has changed in the last couple of years and people are talking about it. How make things better? How to have a working software bill of material? Take care about those dependencies you have. Maybe think about contributing back. What do you think?
I think, yeah, exactly. I think learning by mistake is really good. I think, for example, I think back to Log4j, I think Log4j was a great push for SBOMs in general. So because it really put an emphasis that so many companies or products didn't even know that they were using this component. And how can you actually today ship things well and create things without knowing what's actually inside? So I think that's, and I think in general, the push for SBOMs and more awareness of what is in all these software products is a good thing because it's going to make it more apparent to more users, more products, more companies, to everyone actually, the amount and what specific products are actually in there, you know, up, down, deeper in your dependencies. And that's also sort of a little bit of a personal pet peeve of mine, because in I do a product that's, we usually stay out of all these ecosystems because we're not part of any usual ecosystem. So usually when people do these dependency trees, my stuff is usually not even there. So we sort of, nope, we're not in there. We're used everywhere, but we tend to fall outside of the dependency trees because we're not part of a lot of the regular ecosystem. So I'm certainly in favor of everyone getting more aware of what everyone is using. In particular, of course, because they'll also highlight for everyone when they're using curl. And I like that.
Yeah, I'm also feeling quite sorry for the maintainers of Log4j and also the maintainer of xadutils or the people behind the OpenSSH project. I mean, we had two additional CVEs last month. But hey, they made a change. So thank you, I guess, and hope that the future will be great and green.
Yes. And I really like to, I've said this in other, I've had a few discussions like this before, of course. And really, I mean, especially in I think, Log4j and in OpenSSH and in a lot of these cases, I don't see a lot of problems in the open source projects. I mean, they got a problem, they got it reported, and they, in many, most cases, actually, they fixed the issues, I mean, immediately, next to instantly. So, I mean, there's nothing to complain about that, right? And I mean, in most of these cases, no proprietary companies even close in sort of response time and reaction time there. So having a fix done in, you know, maybe within hours of the first public knowledge about the flaw. So what else can you do as an open source project? That's what you can do, because everyone can do a mistake, own it, fix it. And okay, of course, you make sure that you try not to repeat it in the future. But apart from that, everything, all of these projects, they did everything right. All of the other ripple effects or, you know, companies not updating for years and years, I don't think that is on the open source projects. That's more of a generic or a problem in the software industry in general, and more of a sign that, again, they can get away with it, so they do. So why bother about upgrading old stuff? People will still keep buying them. The companies will still earn a lot of money. So they can just, you know, that's not really the open source sustainability or anything. That's the different thing.
Definitely. So let's focus on the curl project. So now we heard a little bit about the STF and what it does and how it can support your open source project. Let's talk about how the curl project was founded by STF, but maybe we should start. I'm quite sure that most people know curl, at least I hope so, but let's assume again somebody has been living under a stone. How would you describe the curl project, Daniel? I think there's nobody better able to describe it than you.
You don't think so? I think sometimes I'm too deep into this to actually have a good sort of bird's eye view. But I tend to view, describe it as curl. The project does a few different things, but we primarily do curl, the command line tool, and libcurl, the library. And they do client side network, internet transfers around, specified as a URL. That's why it's in the name. So, and it supports, I think, 28 different URL scheme protocols, basically most known for HTTP and HTTPS. So you do internet transfers up and down, or up and down. That's what it does. And then, of course, it does a lot of different tiny, so you can select different ways to behave. And of course, we have a lot of, you know, support different protocol versions. We can, you can build it in numerous different ways. We support a lot of different TLS backends. And yeah, so it has grown into a kind of a Swiss Army knife for internet transfers, really. So yeah, it's, and it ships then in everything. The command line tool ships in on all the major, I mean, Linux distros, Mac OS, Windows 10, 11, on. Yeah, so it ships and with all distros really everywhere. It is really, really portable. I don't actually know of any other software project that can run on more operating systems. The count yesterday, I think, is 103 operating systems that have run curl.
Wow, that's a lot. So what's the most exotic one? Do you know it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, what's the most exotic one? You know, imagine a list with 103 operating systems. How many can you name?
Yeah.
I mean, just tell me how many operating systems you know off the top of your heart. I mean, I can perhaps come to 25. I don't know. But it's, you know, most exotic. There's such a long list with names I've never heard of before someone told me they run curl on it, you know. I don't know which is the most exotic ones. But yeah, it's really, really everywhere. And of course, it's the library part then that is sort of in most places, because that then makes it integrated into a lot of devices, tools, services, and everywhere. So it's nowadays it is basically in every car, fridge, printer, mobile phone, tablet, pretty much anything that is internet connected runs a copy of curl, or many copies of curl in some instances.
And how do you know that there's 103? Because I know that counting generally of stuff is always hard. Do you just keep a list every time you hear of one?
It's an excellent question. I don't know, because how would I know? I don't have any tracking. So I keep a list because I think it's fun. I think this is fun stats. So I have this list. I have a slide in my regular curl presentation. And sometimes I should boast about it. I post it on social media. Look, curl has been running on these blah, blah, blah systems. And almost every time I do that, someone comes back to me and say, hey, did you forget about operating systems XYZ that I have run it on? And, you know, and you didn't mention blah, blah, blah that I also ran it on. Okay, so then I bumped, add it to my list. I bumped the number. And, you know, a few months later, I do it again. And sort of on and on and on. And pretty much every time I add a new operating system. And, of course, in some of those cases, I just have to trust the person who says that it actually has been running on that OS. Because in a lot of these cases, I never got any code back or anything. So they just tell me that they run it on these operating systems. And in some cases, I know that they have run it on these operating systems, but they never gave me any changes back. So did they do any changes? Or I don't know. But they say it works there. So I have this list. So, well, some of them might then be a little bit more uncertain than others, but hey. It's a huge list. So even if there's one or two errors in there, I don't think that matters too much.
Do you also have a list of all the planets that curl is running on? Because I heard it's more than one.
I have that list. I have that list too, yes. And it's two.
Which is really fascinating. I mean, it's not being used widely spread on the Earth, but also on the Mars robot. You must be very proud, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a fascinating thing. Yes, that's one of my favorite then to bring up in my curl presentation, the slide of number of planets that I've run. You know, number of operating systems, 103, number of planets, 2. Yes. Number of CPU architectures, 28, I think, too. So.
Oh, that's also quite interesting. I need to look that up.
And again, that's it's impossible to name them off the top of your head because it's how can you even come up? No, it's an amazing list. But pretty much anything that is 32-bit or bigger has run curl at some point in some surrounding.
I think it would also be interesting in hearing whether Doom has been ported to more devices or curl, because I know that both tools are quite good idea or starting point in order to port software.
Yeah, but Doom needs a screen.
Yeah, so it must be curl, right?
And input, so yes. I think Doom is more limited. I'm not saying that it hasn't been ported on a huge number, but I couldn't really say. I don't think anyone has counted. Sometimes we have this debate, which is the most widely used software component in the world in general, in which software component runs in most number of installations in the world. And that is, of course, also quite impossible to tell.
Yeah.
But I figure curl is at least on the top list somehow, but it could at least be a competition with a few others.
What's your estimate?
I'm estimating 20 billion installations of curl.
Wow.
But I've been doing that for a while. It's probably a bit more. And also, sometimes I'm going a little bit back and forth how I should count mobile phones, because mobile phones usually have more than one installation of curl. So, because it's usually in a bunch of popular, really, really widely used apps like YouTube or Google Photos, and many users have both YouTube and Google Photos installed. Mm. So you have two installations, or you may also run Spotify and Facebook, and then suddenly you have four. So how many installations is that? Almost 8 billion mobile phones in the world. So yeah.
Maybe you should think about advertising it like Oracle does this for the Java SDK. Once you install it, it says running on more than a million devices. That would be a great opener for the curl installation.
Yes. I actually did a mock-up of that once.
Awesome. Okay, so you started back then, I think, 1998? So it's 26 years.
Oh, actually, earlier. So this journey started in November 1996.
Wow.
Because then I started on another project called HTTP GET. And then I became maintainer of that. And then I took that further. And then I added more protocols. And then I added uploads. And then I renamed it twice. And the second time I renamed it to curl. And that is in 1998. So that's why I count the curl birthday as March 1998.
So how many developers do you have in your project? So you're being the maintainer. Would you say there is a kind of a core team of people that are contributing more regularly? How many people are part of this?
Yes. So there is a few different kinds of developers. There is actually a spelled out core team too. So we are a bunch of people named that we can actually have an internal discussion sometimes. So I know, and I think we are 7 or 8 in that. And if I would just look and who's doing changes over time, I think maybe if we look at who's doing things over a year or 2 or 3, I think we may be 10 or 15 people who are pretty much the same people who are still around. But we have an enormous amount of people who show up a few times and then never again. So the total amount of people who ever authored a commit in curl is 1,288,
wow,
I think, by yesterday. So it's, and most of them just did it once and never came back, or didn't come back yet. I don't know. So there's a really, really that long tail of people. I think that's good. I think it's good as long as we have a low bar, a low friction to do changes. I don't mind if they just do it once and don't come back, as long as it's a good change, right? I merge good changes. It doesn't matter if you do it for the first time and you don't happen to come back. Of course, I don't know that you won't come back the first time, but so I try to do things so that I try to encourage people, of course, to come back or do more changes, but that's not up to me. Most of these, almost every change done to curl is done without me knowing that they're doing the change ahead of time, right? They just show up. One of these days, here's a change you might want, right? A spell fix, a bug fix, a new feature, something. And then we say, oh, that looks nice. Maybe you should just fix this little thing, or maybe blah, blah, blah. And then we take it from there. When it's good enough, we merge it. And then we iterate.
So what would you say, how many times does this consume on your everyday life? How often do you check merge or pull requests command, get back to the users?
So that's what I do. That's my life. So yeah, I start 8 in the morning. I end at midnight or something like that. So, wow. And you know, I respond on every issue and pull request that ends up when they arrive, and I get maybe 10, 15, 20 a day. So it depends on days and what I do. And so, yes, that's, Curl was my spare time project for a long time. So, and I, back to how to do funding in open source. It's really hard when you have it as a spare time project. You know, you try to ramp it up, but how do we actually switch from a spare time project to a full time project? It's not easy. And also doing it as a sort of part time could also be difficult, right? Because you need food on the table. You need to maybe provide for a family and what else? How do you actually change that spare time to a full, to getting money and still eat? So, and in my case, I managed to do that in what I think is an excellent way for my personal. So in 2019, I just switched from having it spare time to full time. And having it before that, I have had this constant pattern of doing 2 hours of spare time hacking on Curl pretty much every day. And since 2019, I can then spend my spare time on Curl and my full time on Curl. So it can do Curl all day, every day. So I'm having a good time. So I spend a lot of, but then an upside of doing it like this is that I usually don't have to count. So when you say, how much time do I spend on that? I don't really know, because I don't track my time. I don't keep up. I don't know. For sure. I just have this feeling, because this is how I work, and you can see my commits, right? You can see my comments, or because that's the awesome part of being a working complete open source, that everything I do is completely open and transparent. I basically, well, I do have emails that are not public, but you know, almost everything I do is completely public and open. And I love it.
So what are your everyday challenges of developing and maintaining Curl? Are there any kinds of tasks that you like or dislike, or you struggle with? What gives you the biggest headaches?
I used to say that the hardest part with open source is humans and not the code. because code is easy, and it's sort of, you can always just work on code until it works, because it's just, you know, sure, you might have bugs, or you can do, but you can always just iterate until it works. But humans are much more complicated. Humans are not logical, or you cannot follow a specification. There's not just, you know, there's not a recipe to follow. But humans are complicated and soft person. I mean, we're different cultures, different languages. We're all in different mindsets. We just show up different expectations. You thought something that wasn't, that I didn't think, or the other way around, and it's really complicated. And so, yeah, I think that is the hardest part. You know, insults from people, or just people being, I don't know, maybe not even intentionally insulting or mean or bad, just, you know, having their mindset on something else. And, you know, always this constant being, writing things online or in text, that also much more difficult, because the subtext go away. And writing everything in English is also a struggle for some, right? So you get more thorny, and, you know, you're very direct maybe. And maybe that can appear very offensive or maybe insulting in some ways, but the person who wrote it actually didn't intend it. So I think in many ways that's the hard part. Or sometimes it's also a hard part to then talk about things with humans. You know, you proposed this thing, but that's not exactly what we want. Maybe we want to do it in that direction, and have that back and forth, which is usually much more easy. Like we do now, we have face-to-face, we have voice, and we can see each other's face expressions. That's a much easier way than, you know, doing it over text in a pull request on GitHub. So I think that's probably the hard one, at least one hard part. That's the human part. But usually there's also so many great people and awesome contributors. So I think generally, of course, the good parts are so much better and much sort of bigger, all things considered. So in general, I think working in open source is just awesome.
Daniel, do you happen to know if anybody's like entry to programming or software development was through the Curl project? Well, someone was like, oh, I needed this, and now I want to make a change, and now I'm learning how to program?
No, I don't think, haven't heard about it like that. I think, and as longer as we go, right, Curl also becomes more of a, how we should call it, difficult project to contribute to. And I don't mean that we are a complicated project, but we are using a programming language that fewer and fewer are actually being taught in school, which gives us this challenge that we're, I mean, in general, open source projects have another problem with just age, right? We're all growing older, and open source projects in general tend to then, right, when the average age grows with 1 year per year, that's not good, right? But in our case, we have this struggle then that we're writing almost everything in the language C, which is a very old language and not being taught that much anymore. So the youngsters have a problem to approach it just because of that. And also, it's a little bit low-level network fiddling, so I don't think it's that easy for an absolute newbie to get into if you never programmed before. But I've had a lot of success stories from people who have mentioned that their contribution to Curl has helped them to, you know, as a career move, to show, look, I have my code here, now you can hire me. And I think that is awesome.
That is very cool. Wow.
So when did you discover that your project reached a point of momentum? You mentioned that it started as a side project, and was there a special point in time where you realized, okay, it's a big thing right now and I need to change some things?
I don't think I changed much because of it. But and it's really hard to, what does momentum mean, right? Or what does success mean? When do you, at what point is it successful, or at what point does it have a momentum? I don't know that. I mean, what's the answer to that? I usually say that sort of, I have this awesome screenshot from my website from November 1998, which is, when I did Curl in March, and then November later that year, I counted 300 downloads of my latest release that same month. And I figured, wow, that was cool. 300, what? That's many more than I have friends, right? So it's more my friends and a few others too. That's awesome. That's success.
Yeah.
And that's, among the half joking too, right? Because success or momentum is a matter of mindset more than anything else. Because how do you measure that? Sure. At some point, I think in 2010 or something, I did this estimate, how many are actually using Curl? And I started to Google around, you know, trying, and how do I find who's using Curl? I have no idea how many are using Curl. I can't tell that. So I, you know, Google for my license or products, or just figure out. And then at that time, I think I made a count that this is 300 million users maybe.
Whoa.
So, and you know, that's a mind-boggling number just to come up with. And that, somewhere in that area, I started to realize, sure, that's a huge volume of users out there. But at the same time, looking in, you know, in the communication, in the project, on the mailing list and the issue tracker and everything, it doesn't change there. It is no sense of difference. People are still reporting bugs. People are still whining when things don't work. People are still, you know, and at the same time, the successful ones, the ones who are actually installing it in an app and runs it in billions of installations, never heard from them. And you know, the success stories, you don't hear from them in open source projects typically, right? Because then it works as expected, as documented. So they're happy, they just won't come and whine because it works for them. So it's a little bit of a, in that aspect, it's hard to feel that the project is successing because the atmosphere and the sort of the everyday development is very similar back in the late 90s as it is today, really.
Okay, so speaking of supporting Curl, I know that the Curl project has been supported before the STF. I think you had a number of companies that supported the project. There are things like Open Collective. What can you tell us about those two options?
Open Collective is a great way for a open source project to receive funds, because I think Curl is not alone in this. We have this fun challenge that we're Curl, but we're not a company. We're not an organization. We don't actually exist. We're a name, but what's the name here? The domain name is mine, personal, but Curl as an entity doesn't really exist. So when someone wants to donate money to us, who do they donate that to? I don't want that money to end up in my personal bank account, because that would give me some weird, you know, tax situation or management that I really don't want. And I also always try to stress that I'm not the project, right? The project is not me. We're separate entities. So I really would not want that. So then Open Collective is a great way for an open source project for them pretty much to hold on to our funds. So when someone wants to donate money to Curl, they donate it to Open Collective, you know, earmarked for Curl. So they have our treasure trove over there. It's a pile of money. So when we have someone who wants to give us money because they appreciate what we've done, they want to make sure that we're sustainable, they hand their money over to Open Collective and they tell us, hey, you receive money. And then we can spend that money on activities that we want to spend. So pretty much they hold on to that and we can decide what to do with that money. It's also a good from, which is really not a good aspect as a European here, but as a global citizen, it's good that they're American, because they're an American nonprofit, which is helpful for American company donors to do that. Mm. They could do it tax deductible somehow, which is helpful. And especially if you have a large amount of potential American companies as sponsors, which we happen to have. So it works really well.
Okay, let's talk about your experience with the Sovereign Tech Fund. I know that you have been founded back in 2022 and 2023. How did it came out for you? What were your experiences? Anything you want to share with our listeners?
Since we got into this as part of the pilot program, as we've said now 22 times, there were some initial sort of rules and guidelines that don't exist anymore. But for example, we pretty much had to make projects that it should pretty much last for 6 months. And we also had to meet a lower sort of, well, at least amount of money. So we had to make sure that we asked for money enough at a certain level and do that in 6 months, which meant that we pretty much put together a list. Here are a bunch of things that we were going to work on next. And so we had a bunch of things that we wanted to do. And then in order to make sure that we got up to the amount of money, I couldn't do that alone. So I had to make sure that we were more persons involved to do the job, really, which I also appreciated, because I've always wanted to end up in a situation where we can spread out the load and also make sure that other people can sort of participate as funded developer in the project. So I got help from a German friend, Stefan Heising, who then took part and did part of the projects that we came up with. And it was really smooth, and it was a little bit of back and forth with the STF and Fiona and the others there. And then we pretty much agreed to, we should do these three projects in Curl during these 6 months. So we started, I think we officially started in November 2022, even though I think we actually in practice started a little bit earlier. And then we ended at the, end of April 2023. And it was straightforward. We agreed to funding for these projects. We worked on the projects and we pretty much just reported back the development and the progress in those projects. And these were things that we really wanted to get into the Curl project anyway. So we were just eager and happy to get funding to do that and to do that in more of a focused way, really. So it was excellent. I don't have any really sort of negatives to say about that, other than perhaps going back to it. Sure, we were a pilot program, so everything wasn't as smooth as it should have been, maybe. But I mean, there was nothing to complain about. So everything worked, and we got funding, we got the features landed, and we developed the project for a while there much faster than we would have done otherwise. And of course, we can always theorize on what would have happened if they wouldn't have funded it, but I don't think that's too important.
Yeah. Well, I think from our side, it was really helpful to work with someone who, you know, you're pretty stable, I would say, right, in the sort of greater open source world ecosystem. You've been doing this work for a long time. For us, like, nothing that you probably said or did was a surprise, right? And I think you were able to be flexible and roll with some of the things that we were learning as things developed and changed. I know there was the whole thing about timesheets, which we discovered later on.
Exactly.
I mentioned that before. I mean, we even wrote it into our, and you participated, for example, I think in we had a evaluation, like an external evaluator came in and reviewed and talked to all the participants in the pilot round. And I think, Daniel, you probably also were interviewed for that, and so wrote up the experiences that we had.
Yes. Yeah,
so those were things were a little bit extra, I think, that you wouldn't necessarily have, although we are always trying to evaluate our programs as we go along. But that was something in particular, which when I first started at an STF a little over a year ago, I read the evaluation report and I learned a lot of things, which I'm sure some of them were things that you told the researcher and the evaluator. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And again, I think as a sort of working open source, you're sort of accustomed to, of course, we improve everything as we go along, right? We're never done. We're never finished. And nothing is ever complete and finished. So if we can contribute back improvements, then we do that. And we sort of iterate and we do it better next time. So of course, it's just in our nature to, of course, we want to, if we experience stuff that, sure, here's some friction, this should be done in a better way, then of course we try to just communicate that and maybe facilitate so that it gets better the next time. That's just natural.
Well, I appreciate the attitude, and I think it does benefit everybody. So thank you, of course.
Awesome. And thanks a lot to you two guys for all the information that you shared with our listeners. It was a pleasure talking about all those topics and getting your insights on those topics. So maybe let's sum up with a call to action, maybe starting with you, Pawan. What would you suggest our listeners that might got interested in the meantime in Sovereign Tech Fund? How should they start? Where should they start? How can they contribute? What would you suggest them?
Well, yeah. You know, as a communications person, I have to say, please go to our website. We really do try to keep it up to date. If you learn about things, there's an RSS feed on our blog, if you're still using RSS, which I also do personally. We have a newsletter, which you can subscribe to. We're on a bunch of social media just because, you know, sometimes it takes a little while longer to get the newsletter out. So you'll hear the announcements first on social media, of course. But I think overall, I would say if you want like a real call to action, it's to talk to people in your life. If you work in software, if you're now aware more about open and digital infrastructure, to like point it out, you know, hey, did you, like, this is how it works. There's people out there doing work for free, keeping everything together. How do we support that? Maybe you mention it to people you know who are involved in politics, who are setting digital policy, who are thinking about what areas governments should be active in. I think, not saying go out and turn into a lobbyist, but I think everybody needs to hear, right? Like, we hear about schools, hopefully. We hear about roads being broken. We hear about, you know, needing to build new train lines and, you know, develop new technologies for energy. But there's also a lot of stuff that's invisible, and a lot of that is, for better or for worse, open source software components. Yeah.
Yeah. And we definitely need to get rid of this XKCD comic with that guy living in Nebraska. So please, people, join the STF in order to make this an outdated meme, right?
We use that comic a lot. Yeah.
2347, as we like to say.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I think we can also use that meme for that episode, with the only difference that Daniel is not living in Nebraska, but in Sweden. But I think it relates pretty good to that comic, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so speaking of calling to action and contributions, Daniel, what would you suggest our listeners? Are you still looking for new contributions in the project? Are there any special areas where you would like to see more contributions? How should people get started?
Well, as I said, I think you, all projects always look for more contributors. I'm kind of surprised sometimes when people say, oh, I didn't know you were looking for contributors. I mean, you should take that for granted that every existing open source project needs more contributors and contributions. So I would rather open it and say that you should just consider helping out in any open source project and rather preferably one you use or you like or you think about and, you know, and because contributing to open source is best when you do it out of maybe not passion, but need or desire or because you think it's fun. So find a project where you think you have something to do, fix a documentation or bug or participate there and try to help out. And if they're not friendly and your contributions aren't sort of seem to help out, then pick another project. I mean, there are millions of them and all of them will, well, as I said, there will be a few exceptions, but your contributions will be appreciated in most of them. And also I would say that if you work in a company using and working with open source, you should push your management to make sure that you get to participate and help out in the open source projects that your company is working with and on and using. So that sort of to help the entire infrastructure ecosystem more.
Very wise words. And I think every contribution can be valuable. So let's say you are not very good at writing code, which also relates to me. I'm a lousy coder, but I can fix documentations, I can create presentations, I can talk to people, I can encourage people in order to join. And that can also be a very valuable contribution, right?
Oh, absolutely. And every new contributor can also, you know, become a maintainer eventually and help other contributors. So we need more contributors to get more contributors, right? So, of course, and everyone has been a newbie once and rookie and learned this for the first time. So that's not unique for anyone. No one of us knew this from the beginning. We all learned it. So learning it is part of this.
Definitely. Very wise words. I'd like to summarize this episode with our tool and media tips. And I'm going ahead with a book that you wrote, Daniel. It's Everything Curl, which is also available online. So it's not a book that you need to buy. It's available online. And it's really, really, really long. And there are so many things about curl that I never heard about. Very curious parameters and it's quite worthy having a look at the book. So whenever you have, let's say, 20 or 30 minutes and you don't know what to do with your lifetime, just open the book at a random page and see what you will find there. So very valuable. You will find the link in the show notes. But maybe, Daniel, as we have you here in the round, can you share with us how this project got started? And did you even also learn new things when writing the book?
I don't know all of this by heart. So yeah, some of it I'd actually have to look up and make sure that I'm thinking about it in the right terms. So even though I think I have written all of this myself, so most of it I actually know. But it's sometimes it's a good thing to just write things down, right? Because it makes you think about them in a different way than just, you know. So having to explain how things work makes you sometimes think about it and realize that you should actually perhaps consider it another way to do it or stuff like that. So yeah, it started just because I wanted to, we have a lot of documentation for curl, I would say, but all of that before this book was more of this, you know, reference style documentation. If you know what to look for, you look for that and then you can read how that works. But if you don't know what to look for, where do you start? And that's how I started this. So I wanted to somehow offer new ways to learn about the things. So I wanted it to be more of a tutorial or read through style rather than just a reference, look up an option, you already know what it's called and you look for it. So that's that kind of documentation we already had. So I wanted to cover more ground.
Very interesting. So let's talk about the next tooltip. Daniel, what do you bring to the table?
Oh, I want to suggest a really niche and nerdy tool. And I like this because it's one of those things. As a developer working with C and binary sizes, having data and you know, and I have a lot of since I work with C, there are a lot of structs that are run in memory, and I often work with trying to squeeze things and optimize how things work, in particular on some particular platforms then that are more sort of sensitive to data sizes, perhaps, or not. And then I appreciate this tool called PA hole. I don't know what the P and the A stands for, but it's a tiny tool you can use it for a lot of different things. But in my case, I use it primarily for properly displaying sizes of structs in my C program. So basically, this struct, it gets laid out like this in memory, and you know, you get holes, you get alignments of different data sizes in structs. So maybe you get a lot of holes in a struct. And a lot of holes is ineffective, because why do you need a hole in a struct? You can rearrange the struct fields to reduce the number of holes, and then make structs smaller without, you know, there's no sacrifice really. Just put them in another order and you can make them smaller. So that's what I do sometimes. I just learned about this tool a few years ago. So I figured it's not on everyone's radar.
Great. Thanks a lot for sharing. What about you, Paun?
I was just going to say, I don't understand C and structs, but it reminds me a little bit, because I'm not a C developer or any kind. But when I was little, I used to watch Windows defragment a drive. It kind of makes me think of that.
Exactly. It's very similar, sort of, but this is very manual. This just shows you it's defragged. Do something about it. And then you have to move them around manually, run it again and check. Was it defragged? Yes, it was. Or no, it wasn't. I misunderstood.
But I also do have a couple tips. Actually, I just realized that I had two things I wanted to recommend. The first one is the Open Source Security Podcast, which is because I'm learning constantly and want to know more. Kurt Seyfried and Josh Bressers, they talk about, in pretty understandable terms, all sorts of open source related security issues. They have good energy with each other, so I can definitely recommend that, even to people who are not deep in sort of the software security world. So it's pretty understandable even for me. And the
I can really second that. It's a great podcast.
Yeah, you should also especially listen to the episode with one of the STF founders, Fiona Krakenberger. She's one of the older episodes.
I've been on it too.
Oh wow, I'm surrounded by luminaries. but I have another book which is actually really good for if you're thinking about trying to explain, you know, all the stuff about digital infrastructure and what's going on. And it's something that everybody at the Sovereign Tech Fund reads when we start working here. It's called Roads and Bridges by Nadia Ekbal. And it was originally commissioned by a foundation, and it's called the subtitle is The Unseen Labor Behind Our Digital Infrastructure. And it's also written in a way that you don't need to be a software developer to understand. It even explains open source, actually, if you want to give a gift to somebody who's just, I don't understand what I thought Apple and Microsoft are making my stuff. And you're like, no, there's thousands, hundreds of thousands of people out there doing this, often for free. And so that's my recommendation.
I think I'm credited in the book too.
Oh.
Very good, very good.
I'm everywhere.
Yeah, definitely. And you're also quite active on the Fediverse. So, you know, we have this discussion taking place for more than 1 year. What should we do? Beside Twitter, and then often an argument is nobody uses Mastodon. And then I can say, hey, Daniel Stenberg uses Mastodon. He's very active there. So if you write him, he will ping back in a couple of minutes. So
exactly,
that's good way to use that tool instead.
You know, working from home, no colleagues here. I need somewhere to vent and, you know, chat about silly things. That's Mastodon for me.
Yeah, definitely. And it's more, it's way friendlier. People are quite nice, and we don't have an algorithm, so everybody wins here, I think. Daniel and Paun, thanks a lot for taking place in this podcast. I learned a lot, and thank you for sharing all the knowledge and the experience with our listeners. It was a blast having you on the show. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And of course, dear listener, we are also interested in hearing your feedback. So we hope that you enjoy this episode. In case you have any ideas, wishes, or tooltips, feel free sending an email to podcast@sva.de. We're also thrilled in reading your comments on Podigy or your ratings on the podcatcher that you're using. And with that, thanks a lot for listening, and tune in the next time. Bye.